Hello, welcome to the Christ Community Church Sermon Podcast. Christ Community is a multi-site church in the Chicago suburbs. Thank you for joining us today. I hope that God uses it to help you take the next step in your relationship with Him. Enjoy the message.
There's a time in my life when I was an atheist for 10 minutes a day. The problem was I was a pastor at the time. I'd be standing in a worship service and we'd be singing a song. We'd start the song and I'd believe every word of it. And then partway through, I'd have a moment where all of a sudden I'd be like, really? We're doing this? We're singing a love song to a 2,000-year-old Jewish peasant? Like, that's what we're about? You really think this guy came out of a tomb? We're gonna let a Bronze Age document guide our lives? What are we doing here? I was in my 20s. The season lasted for 5 years or more. Part of the time I was a youth pastor, and part of the time I was a theology student. And I had my reasons for my doubts. There were some things going on in my family that were really tragic. I had some sisters who were in abusive relationships, and I was angry. I was angry about what was going on. And I kept thinking, you know, if I had God's power, I would do something to stop this, but apparently God isn't doing something. So am I more loving than God? Or am I more real than God? I was studying scripture and I was digging into it, learning all sorts of things that were really helpful, but I also were running into things that were messy and hard and complicated and hard to figure out. I looked at the church, not just my church, but the church all over the place. And I'd hear the promises, you know, if you come to Jesus, he'll change your life. He'll fix things. He'll set you free from things. And, you know, we're the hope of the world and all sorts of stuff. And then I look at what was actually happening in churches and it felt like we were just tolerating mediocrity. We promised so much, and what were we getting? I had a friend who walked away from the whole thing. He was as bought in as I was. We had been on mission trips together. We had led people to Christ together. And he came out and said, you know, I just don't believe it anymore. I just, you know, not a word of it. And I sat down with him. I heard his reasons, and they were good reasons. They made sense. I understood why he walked away. Growing up, my faith was really solid. And it wasn't because I avoided hard questions. I love hard questions. That's kind of my personality. Like, give me the hardest question you can find. Like, that's what I wanted. It's just that the answers I got at the time seemed satisfying to me. But at this point, all of a sudden they weren't. It was like I was seeing Christianity from the outside for the first time and it looked ridiculous. And when you get to that place, you start asking the questions like, have I built my life on something that turns out not to be true? I've invested a lot in this. If you've been there, if you are there, you know what I'm talking about. What do you do when the house around you starts to feel shaky? And we're starting a series today on doubt and deconstruction. We're gonna talk through the end of November here. And this is a series for those of you who are asking these sorts of questions, maybe not out loud, but in your heart, you're wrestling with these things. Or for those of you who know someone who is. You say, I'm looking at someone who once was bought in, maybe they grew up in the faith or they've been walking with Jesus for a while and all of a sudden they're wrestling with these things or maybe they've walked away. What do you do? What do you do when the doubts build up and you just can't ignore them anymore? What do you do when someone gets to the place where they say, this Jesus thing just isn't working for me? We're gonna look at a story today in Mark chapter 9. If you got a Bible, turn with me there. It's a story of a man who's about at that place where he's saying, I'm not sure this is working for me. This comes immediately after a literal mountaintop experience. Jesus has taken three of his disciples up onto a mountain and Jesus revealed his glory. We call it the transfiguration. This is like a huge high point. And these guys come walking down the mountain. They come back into the real world and it's like craziness is going on. All of the mess, all of the struggle, all of the pain. And they encounter a group of people who are arguing. This is what happens. Verse 14. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. And what are you arguing about with them? He asked. A man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son who's possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. You unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It's often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if he can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, said Jesus. Everything is possible for one who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that the crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he looks dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? He replied, this kind can only come out by prayer. I thank God for speaking to us. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. We want to start by talking about what it's like when you are experiencing deconstruction. And I got to start with a few definitions here. Okay, three terms that are really important. Doubt, deconstruction, and deconversion. What doubt is the thing we've all experienced, where you have uncertainty about something you believe. You bump into something where you say, oh, wait, what if I got this wrong? And you start to wrestle with something you used to believe. And maybe at the end of the wrestling, you say, I don't believe it anymore, and you change your mind. Or at the end of the wrestling, you say, I still believe that, and you hold on to it. But this is a normal thing. We're small creatures. We're limited. We don't know everything. And so it's going to happen over and over again in our life that we run into things that we realize, oh, I had the wrong idea before this, and you change your mind. And that's okay. If that never happens to you, it's probably a bad thing. Like if you think you'd have all the answers and you never need any new input, that's not a healthy place to be. So doubt is normal and maybe even good. On the other end of the spectrum is what we might call deconversion. Deconversion is when someone used to have a commitment to Jesus and they decide, I'm walking away from the whole thing. Used to identify with Jesus, profess faith, be a part of a church, and now I'm saying, I'm done. I'm walking away from the whole deal. If you're here and you're in that place, I realize there are many people who might be here in that place. I just want to acknowledge that. You might be here and you say, I don't believe any of this stuff anymore. The only reason I'm here is because someone drags me, a parent or a spouse or somebody. Or maybe you're here and you know on the inside, you've walked away from this. You don't really buy into all of this. But on the outside, you're going through the motions because you're scared. You don't know how to tell people. You don't know what the impact will be if you start to say, I don't know what I think about this anymore. Or maybe you're here and you walked away a long time ago. But for some reason, you're curious again. You're hungry again. You decided to stop into a church again. Whatever the reason, I just want to acknowledge the courage it takes to be in a place like this. Hearing everybody celebrate things that you don't believe and listening with an open mind to something that you're not really sure about, that takes a lot. And I just want to acknowledge it's not an easy thing. We're glad that you're here. In between the doubt and deconversion, though, is an idea that we might call deconstruction. Deconstruction. And if you have ever studied philosophy or literary theory, I realize there is a very technical definition of that word. We are not using it in that very precise sense. We're talking about in the more popular way that many Christians and former Christians are using it these days, to simply talk about when you are rethinking your entire belief system. You're thinking about the whole thing, not just one individual idea here and there, but you're looking at kind of the load-bearing walls of your worldview and saying, do these still stand? Like, can I really trust this, you know? There's a guy named Ian Harbour. He wrote a great book called Walking Through Deconstruction. It's one of the ones we're recommending for this series. And he likes to use the term crisis of faith to describe what's going on. Because it's not just a question, it's a crisis. You're struggling with this. You're saying, can I really do this? And it matters because it's not secondary things. It's saying the things that I've really built my life on, the things that I really rely on, can I still hold on to this? And there are a lot of people these days who are experiencing that. Now, it's not a new phenomenon. It's been going on from the beginning of time. But there are a lot of people who are openly talking about, especially within a Christian context, this process of rethinking their faith. Why does this happen? Where does deconstruction come from? What sets it off in someone's life? My really simple answer to that is it happens when there is a gap between your expectations and your experience, a gap between what you expect and what you experience. I mean, think about the guy in this passage. You read the description of what he's gone through. It says, my son's possessed by a spirit. It seizes him, throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth. He becomes rigid. I guarantee that whatever this guy thought about his life, he did not expect it to turn out this way. He, whatever he thought, this is what it's going to be like to be a dad. This was not it. When he was young, he didn't think, this is where my life's going to go. He's probably someone who believes in God and trusts in him. And he's saying, this is not what I signed up for, right? And then there's another expectation that's dashed. He says, I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. He comes to Jesus and this group of people around him thinking, there's some power. I heard some good things are going on. My expectation is they're going to be able to help me. And they did nothing for him. They could not help at all. That gap between the expectation and the experience is where the doubt comes in. But by the end of this conversation, he's saying, if you can do anything, Jesus, the if lives in that gap. Maybe you've come to that place. You say, I wonder if Jesus has anything to offer me. But when the gap gets big enough, that's when you start to rethink things. You start to reevaluate what you actually believe and depend on. These days, I think there are a few common gaps that arise for a lot of people that lead to deconstruction. Let me tell you about three of them. The first is the gap between rigid faith and complexity. Rigid faith and complexity. Some of you grew up or came to faith in what we might call a fundamentalist environment. It's a place where everything was black and white. They had answers to every question. There was a lot of certainty that this is the way it is. This is right. This is wrong. And there were rules for all sorts of behavior. And the hallmark of a fundamentalist environment is that when they answer questions about secondary things, they make them seem like non-negotiables. So there are certain things in the Christian faith that you say, we all got to buy into this, okay? And the list is relatively short. You know, it's things like Jesus is God. He rose from the dead. There are certain things that are just kind of definitional for being a Christian. But when you get to the secondary things that we can debate and disagree on, in a fundamentalist environment, they say, no, you can't. We've got the answer about the age of the earth or how the end times are going to go or the role of women in the church or whatever. Different people can disagree, but we have the right answer. You can't deviate from this. And so in that environment, your rigid faith causes you to put up walls between other people who disagree with you, other Christian groups, people from the outside, non-Christians, and say, we got to stay in this safe little space in here. But what happens if you have been shaped in that environment and all of a sudden you encounter the complexity of life? You start to realize the Bible is not quite as clear as they say it was. There's some messy things that people can interpret multiple ways here. You meet some people outside of your group and you realize they're not bad guys. I mean, there's some non-Christians out there doing some great things. They got some points too. Other Christians seem to have a relationship with Jesus. What's happening? Science, it seems to have some reasons to believe in an old earth or evolution. And you start to wonder about these things, and the complexity creates a gap between your rigid faith and the things you're encountering. And in that gap is the space where deconstruction happens. You got to rethink some things. Another common gap is the gap between therapeutic faith and suffering. Therapeutic faith and suffering. Okay, you know what the most common religion in America is? It's not Roman Catholicism. It's not the Southern Baptists. It's not Mormons or Muslims or Methodists or any of those things. Sociologists who study religion say the most common belief system in America is something called moralistic therapeutic deism. And you say, I have never heard of those words, okay? You don't have to remember those words, but I'm sure you have heard the message. The message of moralistic therapeutic deism is this: God is there to make sure your life is easy. God is there to make sure you feel good about yourself. God is there to help you fulfill your goals in life. And so the message of this is be a good person, believe in yourself, and live your best life, and God's gonna help you with that. That's what God is there for. And a lot of people instinctively do this, right? It doesn't matter what official religious group you're a part of. You think, you know what? If I'm gonna go to God, the reason I'm gonna do that is because he's gonna help me through the hard things and make it all work out. And we get the message in all sorts of different places. Disney's going to tell you that, social media and pop psychology, and a lot of churches will send that message. But what happens if you've imbibed that message and you say, this is the way it's going to work with God, and all of a sudden your life gets hard? You're single when you want to be married. You can't have children. Your career or your health or your marriage falls apart. What happens if following Jesus makes life harder rather than easier? When you've got to sacrifice something? When following Jesus means you've got to deny a desire that you have or give up a longing or a dream that you have, because to be faithful means going this way rather than that way. What happens when life gets hard? And you say, but where was the God who was supposed to help me, you know, feel good about myself and have an easy life? Where was the promise of all of this stuff? It doesn't seem to be delivering. A gap opens up between the expectation and the experience, and deconstruction happens. A third common gap is this: the gap between idealistic faith and actual Christians. Idealistic faith and actual Christians. I love it when someone gets excited about the vision of who Jesus is, right? Like, it's incredible when someone says, I see who Jesus is. He's amazing. The way of Christ is just so compelling. I want to live that way. Sometimes people get a vision of the kingdom of God. They say, this is the way the world should be. This is the things we should chase after. This is what we should be doing out there in the world. They get a picture of the ideal community. They read the one another's in the Bible and say, what if we all did that? They read Acts chapter 2 and say, that should be the community in the church. We should try and do this sorts of thing. Worship could be incredible. Our life can be incredible. I want to do this. And they get hardcore. They get radical about it. They have super high expectations. I used to work at a Christian college. There were all sorts of kids like this. They'd be like, this is what we want to do. What happens, though, when all that idealism that seems so good encounters real Christians in a real church, and they are real human beings? Guess what? They find out we're hypocrites. We're lukewarm. You look around, you see scandals, churches that are bringing in politics into everything. They're shallow and consumeristic. And the actual relationships, you think, oh, it's gonna be like Acts chapter 2. It's gonna be wonderful. Well, they're messy and people hurt you and you walk away with scars. What do you do when that happens? Your idealism encounters actual Christians. You know the first step that happens? You start to get cynical. You start to look at those Christians over there like they don't get it. But the next step is you start to deconstruct. You start to ask, is all of this real? My personal experience, it came from all three of these gaps. But the idealism was the thing that made my faith the most fragile. Because I looked at it and I said, man, I don't see this ideal lived out anywhere. I looked at myself and I said, I don't even think I can live up to this ideal. And as soon as I had those thoughts, the next thought came in. If I don't see this ideal anywhere, what if it's not actually true? Like maybe we're fooling ourselves. Maybe we're selling a product that doesn't actually do what we say it does. Like if this was working this way, if this is what we're supposed to see, why don't we see it? Maybe this is false advertising. And it opened me up to all sorts of other cynical and critical voices. Back then it was the early 2000s, so we didn't have YouTube or TikTok or anything like that. So we actually read blogs, like long form, like written words on the page, right? But I'm reading these things, I'm like, man, they've got some good points. I get this. And it started to chip away at my confidence. Are you experiencing any of these gaps? Many of us are. Many of us are. And if you're in a period where you are rethinking things, when you're experiencing what you might call deconstruction, I want to tell you a few things. First of all, deconstruction is normal. It's normal. People who study faith development, when they look at how people grow over time in their faith, that one of the really common things is they say, you start off with something that is a simple faith, right? You first learned about Jesus, maybe as a child, maybe as a new believer, and you learn about that. And there is a tendency to grab onto those simple things and make them simplistic. And what ends up happening is those simplistic versions of the faith that you have run into problems and challenges and complexities, and you have to look back at them and say, wait a minute. What if I misunderstood? What if there's more? What if some of these things are cultural things, not the actual things that are in the Bible? And you've got to challenge that simplistic faith, that immature faith, and you hit a wall and it can get really hard. But on the other side of that wall is a more mature, robust faith that says, oh, wait. I can come back to some of those simple things, but I've wrestled with complexity. This is a good process that all of us need to go through at some point. It's very common for someone who grows up in a church environment when they get to their 20s or young adulthood to ask these questions and go through that process saying, what am I gonna keep that I inherited? And what am I gonna cast off? And what am I gonna rethink? And what am I gonna hold on to so that they can get a solid faith that will sustain them for a long time? It's a good thing. A second thing you need to know is that deconstruction makes sense. That this is, it's the sort of thing that people look at people who are asking the questions, they say, hang on a second, why isn't, you know, hard for you. I get it, you know? And it almost doesn't make sense to people when they hear it from the outside. Or even from the inside, you might say, wait, did I just not pick up something? Like, did I not listen in Sunday school? Or what happened here that this is hard for me and other people seem to, you know, it clicks for them. But I want to tell you, deconstruction makes sense. It's not crazy. When a gap opens up like that, it makes sense that you'd say, did I get it wrong? You got to rethink some things. I also want to say this. Deconstruction is not rebellion. It's not rebellion. There are lots of people who will look at someone who's asking these questions and say, you know why you're doing that? You just want an excuse to sin. You're just looking for a reason to get away with whatever behavior you want to get away with. And so you're questioning all of these things and it's just because you want to do that. But that's not usually the case. Now, I'm not naive, okay? There are plenty of people who start drifting away from Christianity, putting distance between them and God, them and the church, when they start to sleep with their boyfriend or girlfriend or smoke pot or do something else they know is incompatible with the Christian lifestyle. And they start to say, I don't want so much of this in my life. But that's not what we're talking about here. Drifting away or chasing after sin is something that's common for people. But what we're talking about here is a crisis of faith. It's the actual wrestling with, can I believe this anymore? Can I have confidence in this anymore? And because of that, deconstruction is very, very hard. It's a scary thing. It does not feel liberating. It feels intimidating. Because you're saying, look, I built my life around this. My community is based off of this. My sense of purpose in life, my sense of what's right and wrong, my vision of what is good is built around these things. And if these things don't stand anymore, this is very disorienting. And so it's a scary thing. I mean, think about how the guy in Mark 9 feels. He is looking at his son, watching his kids suffer year after year. Jesus asks how long? He says, since childhood. This is a long experience. Can you imagine all the things that he has tried and the prayers that he has prayed and the doctors he's gone to and the places he's looked for help? This man is worn out. This is not a good experience. The question, though, is where does deconstruction lead? Deconstruction, as the name implies, it involves tearing things down. But what does it look like when you build something after that? How do you know it's going to be better than what you tore down? I think of deconstruction a little bit like chemotherapy. There are some of you in this room who say, I would not be alive if it were not for chemotherapy. That chemotherapy was a good thing. It went into my body and it killed cells that shouldn't be there. It took away the things that were hurting me. It took away the things that were killing me. And it made it so that I could be healthy on the other side. But we also know that chemotherapy can damage healthy tissue. It can hurt things that you actually need. And so there's a danger in that. Deconstruction is the same way. There's something good about saying, I'm going to question the simplistic things I've understood. I'm going to challenge those things that seem like cultural additions to my faith and kind of tear those things down. But you can also end up tearing down good, healthy faith that you need. So the question is, what's it going to look like on the other side of the process? A few different outcomes that often come about. For some people, they replace their faith. They simply walk away. This is what we call deconversion. We talked about this. They say, I'm an atheist, I'm an agnostic, I'm spiritual but not religious, but they don't claim the name of Christian anymore. Other people will remix their faith. This is where they will continue to use Christian language and Christian labels, but underneath it, they have a totally different worldview going on. They talk in Christian terms, but what they're really talking about is progressive politics, or self-help, or conspiracy theories, or nationalism, or something else, but they're using Christian religious language to talk about it. If you are headed in either of these directions, I wanna challenge you. Make sure you doubt your destination as much as your departure. This is really important. If you're thinking of changing your whole worldview and what you're doing, it's really easy to see the tensions and the problems in a community that you're already in. That you're in a place where you say, I know all of the problems that go on here. Like, think about this. You could probably tell me a lot more things that are wrong with your family than I can tell you about, right? Like, I'm not on the inside of your family, but you could tell me, well, this person's annoying this way. They've got this problem. These are the arguments that we have all the time and so on. But on the outside, I might think, oh, you guys seem to be okay. But I could tell you about my family. Oh my goodness, right? You've got to ask the question, what are the challenges in the place where I'm going? What are the contradictions? What are the problems? What are the things that might arise if I was rigorously asking the questions there that I am here? You've got to do that work to make sure that where you're going actually makes sense. But there's a third destination that you could end up in, not replacing your faith, not remixing your faith, but renewing your faith. When you're renovating an old house, taking out the old rotten beams and all the weak materials there is a good thing, but you gotta make sure that when you build it back, it's stronger and it's still built on the foundation of Jesus. Sean McDowell, who's an author who wrote a book on deconstruction called Set Adrift that we're recommending for this series, he uses the analogy of being on a paddleboard on the ocean. He lives on the West Coast, so he gets to use illustrations like this. He says, sometimes when you're paddleboarding on the ocean, fog will roll in. And you will lose sight of the shore. And it's very disorienting. He says, you can get turned around, think you're heading in the right direction, you're really heading out towards sea, and it's tricky. He says, this is what deconstruction is like. You start to feel like, I don't know which way is up or where to go. But he says, I left shore, and now I need to figure out a new destination. But he says, when you're disoriented, the goal is not to hope that you can somehow sail out into the ocean and find new land. The goal is to find your way back to the coast, to find your way back to the shore. But he says this, you know, sometimes you end up in a place that's very different than where you started, but that's okay, as long as you end up back at the shore. As some of us, when we rethink our faith, the goal is not to end up someplace totally new, but it might be a new place within the Christian family. Some of you have been through this experience. You've said, I had to rethink and re-put together what I believe, and I ended up in a church that was very different than the one that I came from. Or maybe you're in the process right now and saying, I don't know if I can stick around in a place like this. I feel like something else might be different. That might actually be okay. I don't want anybody to leave Christ Community Church, but I would rather you end up someplace in the wider Christian family where there are lots of people who love and serve Jesus in different ways than end up adrift at sea. This is what you need to do. You want to aim at having your faith be renewed, even if it looks different than it did before. So the question is, how do we end up in that place? In order to end up there, we need to talk about how you engage deconstruction. What does it look like when we're engaging deconstruction? Back to the passage. Look at how Jesus responds to this man. The initial response when people tell him what's going on, verse 19, he says this. He says, "You unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" Now, we always have the challenge when we're reading the Bible, what tone of voice do we hear it in, right? So you hear Jesus say something and you gotta practice all of the different ways he could have said it. And I tried a lot of different tones of voice for this one. Like, hey, is there a gentle way to say, how long shall I put up with you? Is there like a sad way, an understanding, a curious way? No, like there's only one way to say it. Jesus is frustrated. Like, how long am I gonna put up with this? You unbelieving generation. You ask the question, who's he frustrated with? is he frustrated with this man? Now, this is a cheat. I realize you don't all know Greek, but in the Greek, that you, when he says, how long will I put up with you, is plural, which means he's talking about a group of people. Whoever he's frustrated with, it's a group. You know what group I think it is? The disciples. The reason I think that comes at the end of the story. The end of the story, they're together in private and they're like, hey, Jesus, why couldn't we cast out the demon? And Jesus says this, this kind can come out only by prayer. And I thought a lot about that verse. I was like, okay, maybe it's a special kind of prayer, a specific prayer, something advanced that they hadn't learned before. What's going on? And then I realized, no. They didn't do the very basic thing they should have done first. I mean, if someone possessed by a demon ran up to you, the first thing you're gonna do is be like, God help, right? You're gonna pray. And they didn't even do that. The thing that frustrates Jesus is that these guys had a presumptuous faith that said, I got it all figured out. They didn't even reach out to God. They just said, well, it works for us. We're gonna be able to handle this situation. And Jesus looks at that and says, no, this is not okay. That doesn't help anybody. That doesn't have any power. There's no humility in that. And so when someone comes up who's really struggling with real questions and real pain, the thing that they encounter is presumptuous faith. That's terrible. They're gonna bounce right off of that. That's not gonna be any help for anybody. But look at the next thing that Jesus says. Verse 21, the man comes up and he says, how long has he been like this? How long has he been like this? Jesus didn't need to know that information in order to perform this miracle, did he? He didn't need to know about the history. So why did he ask? I think it's because Jesus wanted to hear the words from the man himself. He wanted to hear it in his own voice. And you need to know this. Jesus wants to hear from you how hard it is. He wants to hear about all the pain and all of the questions and all of the baggage and all of the hurt and all of the things you're not sure you can believe anymore. He wants to hear it from your own mouth. Now, he knows it already. He knows what's going on inside, but he wants you to know that he knows. And you need to experience his listening. And you need to know, he's not listening, shaking his head like, oh, gee, you couldn't handle this? That's too hard for you? Oh, what? Come on. He's not doing that. He is leaning in saying, how long has it been? Tell me more about it. What's it like for you? Look at verse 22. The man tells Jesus about this. Says it's often thrown him into the fire, tried to kill him, do all this stuff. But if you can do anything, Jesus, take pity on me and help us. And Jesus responds like this. He says, if you can, everything is possible with one who believes. Now, Jesus is doing something surprising to us here too. He's gently challenging the man. He's saying, all right, you've experienced this gap between your expectations and your experience, but let me talk to you about your expectations. You showed up here thinking that I could help, but you're using language like if. Why is that? What do you actually think I'm capable of? What do you actually think is possible? What do you actually think about me? And this is an important thing. Jesus is not being harsh here. He's being loving. He knows that if this man is to grow beyond his doubt, he needs to be pushed to examine what he believes. What are your expectations? What do you actually think about Jesus? This is an important thing for us to do when we're in doubt, to say, okay, I actually want to think about these questions. The man responds, though. He says, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And this is the key. There's no sugarcoating. There's no hiding, no pretending here. He says it just like it is. Now, honestly, this is where I'm at. I believe, but I got some doubts too. I need help. You need to know this. You have permission to be honest about your doubts. You can say them. You can say them out loud to God and to other people. You can invite other people in. You can invite God in. You need to do this. So many people go through this, and the only thing they have is their own thoughts and the internet, and that's not a great place to be. You got to be able to bring those things directly before God. You need to admit the question, because here's why. You will experience more of Jesus in honest doubt than presumptuous faith. You will experience more of Jesus in your honest doubt than presumptuous faith. Admit your questions. Be honest with them. But you need to go the next step too. You need to say, help me, help my unbelief. You need to not just admit the questions, you also need to seek the answers, to lean in and say, maybe there's something that addresses this, there's some new way to understand this. I wanna promise you, you are not the first person to ask the questions you're asking. There have been lots of people all through the ages who have wrestled with the very same things. And I know you are a smart person, but I guarantee other smart people have asked those questions, wrestled with the answers, and come to some sort of answer that made them say, you know what, this is enough for me to at least stick with Jesus. And so what I want to encourage you to do is to actually say, could those answers be satisfying for me? Like if these smart people were convinced enough to stick with Jesus, maybe I can listen with an open mind and say, maybe they've got a point there. Will you listen to that? We're going to spend the rest of the series talking about some of the really common questions that people have in doubt and deconstruction. We're going to talk next week about, is the Bible morally backward? You know, what about all the slavery and all of these sorts of things in the Bible? In a couple of weeks, we've already talked about this. We're going to talk about, are science and faith compatible? We're going to have an MIT professor come in and we're going to interview him and say, all right, let's wrestle with this. Can you really believe both of these things? We're going to ask the question, would God send somebody to hell? Why is the church so messed up? Do Christians hate LGBTQ people? These are questions that make people say, I don't know if I can stick with this. So we're going to wrestle with it. And I'm not promising an open shut case. I'm not saying you come the next few weeks and all your questions will be answered. You'll never ask another one. I'm not saying that. I just want us to model how to honestly ask the questions and seek answers. And maybe that'll help. The last week of the series, we're going to do one called When Someone I Loved Walked Away. Like, well, what do you do when it's not you, but it's someone in your family or a dear friend, a spouse, somebody that you say they used to believe and now they don't? How do you handle that? We're going to talk about that. But here's what we want to do. We want to honestly seek and be honest about the real questions and seek real answers. There's a couple of stories in the gospel that I think are really illustrative of this. Two stories that are in the gospel of Matthew, and they're just a couple chapters apart, which is why they're so interesting. The first is the story of John the Baptist. John the Baptist was the forerunner to Jesus. Jesus is hype man, and he's there telling everybody, this is the guy, look at him, look at him. And if there was anybody who had a reason to believe in Jesus, it's John. He baptized Jesus, and when Jesus comes out of the water, the heavens open up, and God's voice declares, this is my son. So no reason to doubt there if you're John. But then John ends up in prison for the things he's preaching. And he's there in prison, and he's thinking, oh, wait, I know the scriptures. The scriptures say that when the Messiah comes, he's gonna set the captive free, and I got locked up. So maybe I made a mistake. So John sends some of his followers and says, go ask Jesus, is he the one, or should we look for somebody else? So his followers go to Jesus, and Jesus says, okay, you go back to John, and I want you to tell him something. I want you to tell him what you see. And Jesus goes out, and he heals a blind man and raises somebody who's dead and cares for someone who's poor. And he says, okay, you go tell John all of these things that you just saw. You give him some evidence that maybe I'm the guy he thinks I am. A few chapters later, another group of people come to Jesus, and they basically ask the same question. They say, you claim to be the Messiah. It's the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They say, you claim to be the Messiah. Give us a sign that you are who you say you are. Sounds a lot like what John was asking. But Jesus' response, he says, I'm not going to give you a sign. If all the things I've done aren't enough for you, you are a wicked and rebellious group of people. Why would he respond that way, right? John asked for the same thing that the Pharisees do. He gives John the evidence and he says, I'm not going to give any evidence to you, the Pharisees. I think Jesus knew the difference in their attitudes. He knew that John was looking for reasons to believe. He had good reasons to doubt, but he was hoping that it was true. The Pharisees are looking for reasons to leave. They had good reasons to believe that they were hoping for evidence that it was false. John wanted to stick with Jesus. The Pharisees wanted to reject Jesus. And Jesus says, I'm not going to play that game. If you come honestly, really open-minded to say, is this true? I'm going to give you what you need. If you come and say, it doesn't matter what you say, I'm not going to believe. I don't want to believe. Then Jesus is saying, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to play that game. I think about how children ask questions. You know, there's a lot of why questions. You've been around kids. It's like, why? But there are lots of different ways they ask that question. Sometimes a why question is very curious. They're like, why don't fish drown? Why can't you tickle yourself? Why do adults drink coffee when it tastes so terrible, you know? And they have these curious questions. And when a kid asks that question, it's so much fun because you lean in and you say, okay, let me explain it to you. You know, when my kids ask those questions or kids at the church ask those questions, I'm just like, we could talk about this for days. This is so much fun. But sometimes when a kid asks a why question, they're not looking for answers. They're looking for loopholes. So they're like, well, why do I have to go to bed? Why can't I have a phone? Well, why can't I jump off the roof onto the trampoline? Why? Now, you've got a good reason why you're not giving them those things, but it doesn't matter what you say. They aren't looking for the reason. They're not trying to be enlightened by your wisdom. They just want to do what they want to do. And so in those cases, a lot of times as the adult, you say, because I said so. Because if you get into the back and forth of all the reasons, it's just an argument and it's not going to be fruitful. So you just stop the conversation. There are other times, though, when a child is asking why, because they're in pain. They're insecure. Why do my friends treat me that way? Why am I scared all the time? Why do I have bad dreams? Why do you have to go on that trip and leave me here? Why? And in those moments, what do you do? When my kids are asking those questions, I draw them as close as I can and I give them a big hug. And sometimes I explain what's going on, but I also know that those explanations don't take away the pain. It doesn't make it easier for them. But what I most want them to know is that I'm close to them, that I love them, that I hear them, that they are not on their own in that pain and insecurity. And I think this is how God is. When we come with curious questions, he loves to give answers and evidence and all sorts of stuff. When we come saying, I'm just interested in doing what I want to do, he says, I'll wait until you're actually open. But when we come in pain, he draws us close and says, I got you in this. Even if the answers aren't enough to satisfy, I'm with you in the pain and in the question. This is the key. You need to let your doubts and your questions and your pain drive you towards God, not away from God. Towards God, not away from God. There's an Old Testament story, a guy named Jacob. Jacob is a total scoundrel. He is basically the worst, and he double-crosses everybody he's ever met. He swindles and manipulates and tries to control every situation. At one point, it was so bad that he hurt his brother bad enough that his brother wanted to kill him. And so Jacob, he has to flee the country. He has to leave his homeland. And he spends over a decade in another country. And over that time, he grows as a person. He actually develops more of a relationship with God. And God makes a promise to him. He says, I promise that I'm going to bless you and your family and protect you. So Jacob's got this promise and he's living out here. And one day he realizes, I've got to go back to my homeland. I've got to go back home at some point. So he decides he's going to go. And he goes home and he doesn't know what his brother's going to do when he sees him for the first time. And so he goes knowing God's promised to protect me, but my brother is threatened to kill me. Which is going to win? How's this going to go? Is God going to keep his promise? And the night before he's about to cross the river into the land where his brother is and see him, he is desperate. He's thinking, I don't know. And so all night long, he prays. He goes out into the desert. He's praying on his own. He's crying out to God. And a man walks into the desert and starts wrestling with him. We've all been there. It happens in prayer time, you know, just wrestling. Pretty soon you realize this is no ordinary man. This is God himself. And all night long, Jacob wrestles with God. And when the sun is coming up, when the dawn is breaking, Jacob is holding on to God saying, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He's saying, give me some assurance you're gonna keep your promise to me. And God does bless Jacob. But it's very surprising. Two things he does. First thing he does is he breaks Jacob's hip. And now Jacob, who has strutted and swaggered through all of his life, has to limp. He's got to humbly walk into every situation. But the second thing he does is he gives him a new name. You know what the name is? The name is Israel. Now, you've heard that name, but maybe you don't know what it means. Israel means one who wrestles with God, one who struggles with God. I find it amazing that the name that got stuck, not just to Jacob, but to all of God's people was the name Israel, the people who wrestle with God, the people who struggle with God. You are convinced sometimes that when you're wrestling with God, that God is far away from you, that somehow that means you're not a part of his people, that you're distant from that. But God says, no, that's your name. That's who we are. In fact, when you are wrestling with someone, that's the closest you can possibly be to someone. I don't know if you've wrestled, you are very close to the person. And God says, that's what it's actually like when you are wrestling with me. It's an old story about a couple of monks, a young monk and an old monk. And the young monk goes to the old monk and says, what's it like? You've walked with God all of this time. Tell me, do you still wrestle with God? And the old monk says, oh yes, I definitely still wrestle with God. He says, how can you wrestle with God? How can you struggle with God and hope to win? And the old monk says, oh no, you misunderstand. I don't wrestle with God and hope to win. I wrestle with God and hope to lose. And this is the key. This is the posture we need to take. Bring your questions, bring your doubts, bring your struggle. Wrestle with God, but in the hopes that one day you get to the place where God wins and you say, I surrender, I trust you. That's what we're doing. It's okay to wrestle, but let God win. Let's pray. God, we come honest. Small people. We do not have all the answers. The things that you do are hard for us to understand. The things that you say confuse us. Our hearts are resistant and confused, and there are times when we struggle to believe. And so we come and we say, help us overcome our unbelief. God, let us be people who wrestle with you. And we pray that in the end, you would win our hearts fully and completely. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for joining us. After sermons, we like to ask, what was a key takeaway from this message? What will you put into practice from this study of God's Word? At our website, ccclife.org, you can find more discussion questions, a prayer wall to post requests and pray for others, and where you can give to Christ Community Church. If you enjoyed this message, you can subscribe and share it with friends or on your socials. Again, thanks for listening.